Welcome to another edition of Once Upon an Island, Tales from Lopez. I'm Ali Smulders. With me is Laurie Harrison, and we will be doing our December program, which traditionally, this is after all the third, without somebody to interview. We'll talk to each other and to you about our own traditions and about slowing down. And Laurie is going to start. Laurie?
Good day. So I will begin with an excerpt from writers James J. Kilpatrick from his book called Fox's Union. And the name of this piece is Snowbound. The first flakes fell at 7 o'clock. Coming in from the woodpile, I felt the cold, wet kiss of snow. In an instant, or so it seemed, the night had become a magic theater and the hemlocks a corps de ballet. A big spruce was hoop-skirted and ruffled, a small pine in a tutu. Yet the moment was caught on a soundless stage. Living in the city, we forget what silence is. In the whole of the night, only the snow was moving, falling, falling, straight down, straight as lace curtains, sifting, clinging, obscuring the ruts of our red clay road. This was the way it was while Snow White slept, with the woods in ermine and the world enchanted. At dawn, the snow was falling still, and all the world was white on white, the fallen trees embossed upon the hill, the new stone wall a perfect parapet. The mill road had vanished as completely as if an illusionist had waved his wand. There was only a white cotton blanket there now, spread over the split rail crib. When at last the snow stopped, it left behind a wedding cake morning, the trees with pearl-embroidered trains edged in frosted lace. From the kitchen window, we could see only the birds in intermittent flight, red cardinals, blue juncos, titmice, a ragged band of urchin sparrows. All that morning, the radio crackled of meetings canceled, schools closed, speeches postponed, of stores and factories shutting down. And abruptly, the thought struck home. We are snowed in. Ordinarily, any one of our three rural roads will take us out to what provisionally may be styled as civilization. You can go south to Woodville or north to Sperryville or east by way of the Shade Road and come out on Route 211 just past the high school. We telephoned around the neighborhood. It would be pointless, it appeared, even to try to clear the roadway, for the Woodville Road was blocked by 12-foot drifts on down by Clifton Clark's place. The Sperryville Road was blocked at Jim Bill Fletcher's, and the Shade Road was impassable. These advisories produced a twinge of panic, and the mind probes at panic like a tongue at a toothache. If there were a fire, the volunteers couldn't get through. If there were a serious accident, a heart attack, a broken bone, no rescue squad could be summoned. Eventually, we figured someone would come to dig us out. Jimmy Falls would plow around the Woodville Drift in order to get hay to his cattle. Mr. Manwaring would send Bob Grigsby to rediscover the driveway. Highway crews, in time, would do the rest. But meanwhile, we were prisoners. Then a second thought struck home. Accept it. The thought has recurred many times since. In the total sum of man's brief span upon the earth, what would be missed, truly missed? Well, so the choir boys would not rehearse, or the Kiwanians convene that day. So the schoolboys of Culpeper County would miss the conjugation of their verbs. For the time being, there could be no further work upon the new stone wall, but that wall could wait. Somewhere a local court had closed, but justice would be done tomorrow, or the day after, or even next week. It's no bad thing, for a while at least, to find oneself snowbound. In his poignant novel of World War I, The Fountain, Charles Morgan put this feeling of cessation into words. In winter, he wrote, time stands still. Nothing changes so long as snow is on the ground. And when time stands still, there is time for those things one never had time for otherwise. There are books to be read and nuts to be cracked, stamps to be put in the album. Most especially, there is time to talk. We do so little of that these days, for there are always things that have to be done. There are always appointments to be kept, deadlines to be met. We get absorbed in the getting and the spending. Snowbound, it's possible to get absorbed in the things that count, in the giving and sharing of love that glows with a steady lantern's light, in the easy communion of books and conversation. There is a certain freedom in captivity, a certain peacefulness in being held prisoner. In the mountains, the absolute obligations come down to few, to feed the animals, to keep the fire going, to look after the elementary necessities of existence. It's wonderful to discover how many things, without calamity, can be postponed. Too soon the snowplow comes, a great orange beetle, grossly beaked, grinding a path by which schoolboys and choirs and Kiwanians can meet again. We learn from our snowbound days. And of course, Allie, we've already had our first snow of the year. We had a beautiful Thanksgiving snow this year. And I, for one, am hoping for more snowbound, quiet days of Christmas this year.
Well, they're already past when people are listening to this.
That's right.
But what occurred to me as you were reading, this was a time when there was telephone. Mm-hmm. What happened when people were snowed in and snowbound and they could not call their neighbors down the valley? Mm-hmm. You know, there was not a chance. So you were truly, truly alone.
Of course, back in those days, the pre-telephone days, our lists were shorter too.
Yeah.
And our pressures to do more and more.
They were, but there were also then older people who were living by themselves, mm-hmm. and who could not really be helped or checked upon because it was impossible to pass the road to their little farm. Mm-hmm. Wherever they lived.
It's interesting how this piece brings up for me this yearning we have in these years for a slower pace and slower time. But when you look back in the whole scope of time, our experiences of being hurried up during the holiday season are relatively new.
Mm-hmm.
I look forward. One of the things we're going to talk about this morning are Allie's holiday traditions in Holland when things were significantly slower, and my holiday traditions in the 1950s growing up in Seattle, again, when things were slower than we find them today.
Right, right. Well, brace yourself, because in this December talk, I will be jumping around from the Netherlands to the United States mostly, but including some other countries, and jumping around between generations. When I was little, when our children were small, and when our now grown grandchildren were just barely beginning life. And I wish I could show you the pictures of some of the traditions that I have around me, but I will try to explain what it's all about. I want to read you something about the December traditions, which all of us have in different countries. And I'm not speaking about the religious traditions that take place in the month of December, of Hanukkah, of the birth of child of Christ. None of that, just things like Santa Claus and Father Christmas, and Der Weihnachtsmann in Germany, and Sinterklaas or Saint Nicholas in the Netherlands. What was that all about? That is folklore. And folklore is as old as the ages and as new as tomorrow. And it is really strange that we have these figures, these crazy Santas, Father Christmas, and all of that in our rationalized modern Western life. But there it is, and they have at least some connection with official Christian religion, but a very loose one. When it comes down to it, it turns out that Sinterklaas, the Dutch one, is still in full ceremonial robes of a bishop. And he has a mitre and he carries a staff. Santa Claus and Father Christmas, they are both descending from Saint Nicholas, have lost all but the red color of their ecclesiastical vestments, and they also transferred their visits to Christmas Eve and the early hours of Christmas Day, because Saint Nicholas, the original feast day, is actually the day of his death, December the 6th. And that is still the time that Saint Nicholas is celebrated in the Netherlands. And when you read up on all these things, Santa Claus and Father Christmas and Saint Nicholas, then, and you compare them historically, it turns out that Saint Nicholas is the most authentic tradition. And Santa Claus was introduced into America by Dutch settlers in the early 19th century, and we all know that Clement C. Moore's beloved verse, A Visit from St. Nicholas, which was first printed in 1823, that really established his tradition. And what about Great Britain? There is evidence of festivities of winter and the Christmas season, but when the Reformation came, all of that disappeared. And there was a period during Cromwell's time of Puritan rule, and that succeeded almost completely in suppressing those kinds of practices. And it was not until Victoria married Prince Albert, who wanted to enliven their children's holidays with some of his native German customs, that Father Christmas reappeared. And in physical form, more resembling the American Santa Claus than the Dutch Sinterklaas. But in many ways, being like him, bringing gifts. And that's what they all did, bringing gifts. And Sinterklaas, the way it is celebrated in the Netherlands, it's very interesting, because here is this bishop, so very formal, and nobody thinks of any church relation. And it survived the Reformation in Holland, which is most amazing, because it was a very strong one in the 16th century, and actually it was rendered a predominantly Protestant country, but St. Nicholas managed to survive and withstand all attacks. And he stayed the same in his name and in his appearance and also in his popular function. And Sinterklaas Eve, you know, the day before, December the 5th, that's when most of the adults celebrate. And it is celebrated with equal ardor by Roman Catholics, Protestants, Jews, non-believers, anybody. It makes no difference. And the thing that you have to know is that Sinterklaas is accompanied by Black Peter, a tiny Moor. And the thing is that they come from Spain, and nobody really knows why. because Sinterklaas came originally, it was called Greece, but it was actually southwest Turkey, and then his remains were taken to Italy.
You're talking about the historical fellow.
The historical fellow. So, in other words, what does Spain have to do with any of this? Nothing. And why does he come on a ship? And this is very important, because in all the little songs, you hear about his steamboat on which he comes. Well, the whole history of the Sinterklaas traditions really started in the beginning of the 19th century and has become so established that nobody worries about the fact that this was once upon a time a real bishop.
Okay.
Although the legends that go with the fellow are very important, because he did things that carry on today. In other words, he wanted to be nice to children, and he wanted to be very much interested in giving young women a chance to find the man they loved. And that part of the St. Nicholas tradition is still very much celebrated. And while we have some gingerbread men here, in the Netherlands, these dolls are really important, because they are either male or female, and they are sent to the other side, and very important what it looks like and what is going on in that person's life. But the very much fun things about the Sinterklaas celebration in the Netherlands is that gifts are given anonymously. So you never know who did this, who gave this to you. And there will be a little rhyme, a verse accompanying the gift. And in there, there may be things that St. Nicholas was not very pleased about, things that you did in the past year that really could have been better. And you are told in no uncertain terms. And a St. Nicholas verse can actually be telling things to people who are above you, like your boss or somebody in the government. You know, you can tell them exactly what you think, because they will never know who sent that to them.
And when you say St. Nicholas, you mean it's the same as Sinterklaas?
Sinterklaas is just a more popular way of saying St. Nicholas, which is a mouthful. So they say Sinterklaas. And actually, we used to say the Sint. That's what we would call it. Do you have any plans for the Sint?
Okay.
And that was the 5th of December. But that is such an abbreviation.
Let me ask you a question about this. So if I had a boss with whom I had some disagreements, I might write one of these poems.
That's right.
And would it have to accompany a gift?
Well, yes, you would think of something to give him. Maybe you would give him some sweets because you wanted him to sweeten up.
And how are these delivered in such a surreptitious way that no one knows?
You would make sure that you were there early enough before he arrived in his office.
Okay.
And maybe you would tie it to the outside of his door with a ribbon.
Okay.
And maybe you would say, please look, you know, and you would give a strange place in the building where he would have to look, and that's where he would find his gift. Because there is nothing wrong with sending a person from one place to another. That's what you do at Sinterklaas. And you hide things, like you might give, and we did this once with our kids, what are they called? The purple vegetable. Can't think of
aubergine.
Eggplant.
Eggplant, right.
Eggplant, yeah. And it's enormous, right? And I remember we would hide something in there. Say that you gave somebody a beautiful silver pencil, you know. You would do it in such a way that you made an opening that you could fill again. And so the person would really have to look at this eggplant and find, there is a little bit of a... Maybe if I touch it, you know.
Oh, my heavens.
Yeah, but when children are still small, they can't always find that. So it may be very upsetting. It has to be a little bit more obvious for the smaller ones. But for adults, you can give them a hard time. That's the whole idea.
And so also for adults, I mean, like, I think of the gifts I receive at Christmas, it's only with happy feelings that I open the presents, because I know that there are things that people, you know, gifts that they give me with my best intentions in mind. But it sounds like things are different there in Holland. There could be a little barb involved.
There could be, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you might open the gifts with a little bit of more care.
You would open it with care because you never know, you know, something might jump at you. You, that too.
And is it the same for children? Do children get these messages of correction?
No. Well, they do get the messages of direction. Yes, they do get that. Yeah. It's, I will tell you a little bit about that when I read what I wrote for our grandchildren. Okay. But first let me tell you a little bit more about Saint Nicholas, who is, you know, white bearded and friendly and kind and benign and liberal. And he is accompanied by this little black Peter, this black Moor, who is a jolly character, and he is a helper, and he carries a sack. And in the sack are presents, but there's also the possibility of punishment, because all the little songs, the old songs which go back hundreds of years, wie zoet is krijgt lekkers, wie stout is de hart, the sweet child gets goodies, the naughty one the rod. And that he has a rod made out of twigs. And children no longer are beaten with that, but they know that that is something that if you misbehave, you might get a rod as a symbol of a more painful form of punishment. And the children also know that if they are really naughty, they might be carried to Spain in the sack. That is the ultimate punishment, and it says so in some of the old Sinterklaas songs. I don't think anybody mentions that out loud to the little kids. But, you know, St. Nicholas rides on a white horse, a gorgeous white horse. And he does not just go down the street. He, and the help of Black Peter is very necessary, he goes from roof to roof and from chimney to chimney. And it is Black Peter who makes sure that the presents for the children are put down the chimney. And he also, which is very interesting, he has a lot of little goodies. Like, they call them ginger nuts, pepper nuts, Pfeffernüsse in German. And they are little tiny cookies that are somewhat spicy, but they're somewhat hard too. And Black Peter will throw these, and it's very much like the breaking of a piñata, this sudden thrust of goodies coming down. And I remember, but I will tell you more about that later. Anyways, think of them as a couple, like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. They belong together, and they have a contrast in their characters. And I will now read to you a little bit of what I wrote for our grandchildren when they were small, because I felt they should know something about when their grandmother was a girl. So I called it December in Friesland, Friesland being my home province. Late November was cold and blustery. Dark came early, and school wasn't out until 4. I hurried home, my coat buttoned up against a chill wind, and my woolen cap pulled down over my ears. I looked forward to tea with my mother. In the cold hall of our house, there was no central heating, I peeled off my coat and hat and scarf and mittens and rushed into the warm living room, which was heated by a large stove that burned anthracite, a type of coal. My mother sat at a table behind a large tea tray and poured me tea in my own cup and saucer. I plumped down across from her, and mother pushed the cookie tin towards me. It was one I particularly liked. It was black with colorful clowns and circus scenes. When I opened it, I shouted, "Yummy!" The tin was full of speculaasjes, spicy gingerbread cookies, baked in fancy molds. Quite a change from the ordinary plain Maria biscuits. "Well," my mother said, "it's December tomorrow. I thought I'd better." "Delightful December is here," I quoted. "How does it go again?" I asked. I was never very good at remembering a tune, but I always knew the words by heart. And mother hummed, and together we sang, "Delightful December is here, the fifth of the month is near, when good Saint Nick and Black Pete will bring gifts to you and me." So then mother went to the piano and rummaged in the music rack until she found the book she wanted. She played and we sang the December song once more. I wanted to do more St. Nicholas songs, but mother decided we better have some more tea first and some more speculaasjes. They were not the only special St. Nicholas goodies. They were heart-shaped, what was called borstplaat. They were made from sugar in different flavors. And then there were chocolate letters and letters of puff pastry filled with almond paste. They were traditional. And the bigger your initials, the better off you were. My father's initials were M.W. Well, what more could you ask for? I had a Jewish friend whose initials were J.I., Joseph Israels. I mean, miserable for him, you know. He would be jealous of people with names like M.W. Well, I'll tell you, that tradition of these letters dates back to the early 19th century. Of course, there was no cocoa yet, because the Dutch were instrumental in Van Houten, the Dutch chocolate manufacturer, discovered how to make cocoa out of the stuff that came from the Dutch East Indies. And so the chocolate letters didn't come until later in the 19th century, but they are so popular that even today they are exported to Canada, to the United States, to New Zealand, to Australia, all the different countries where the Dutch emigrated to. They still want their chocolate letters at St. Nicholas time. And so that is still happening. Of course, I didn't know any of that when I was small. I would just be very happy to have a chocolate letters and have an A. No puff pastry, that was more for the adults. So I was preparing for our St. Nicholas celebration, and I was old enough to be part of the December the 5th evening where mostly the adults celebrated. And I went to the fancy confectioner shop with my coin purse in my pocket, and I opened the door that normally led to the family's parlor, but that now had been transformed into an annex of the shop. And there were long tables covered with butcher paper, and they displayed all the seasonal treats, baskets of make-believe fruit made of marzipan, and fancy boxes of chocolates, but also small items that a child could afford. The first table on my left was divided in sections according to price. The least expensive treats first, and each section a bit higher in price than the next. The choice was overwhelming, because there were chocolate St. Nicholas figures covered with red and silver foil. There were small pieces of marzipan, looking like chunks of sausage or looking like flowers, and even pieces that looked like a book. And I knew that I could spend as much as a whole guilder on something for my mother. So I slowly made my way along the table from 5 cents to 10 cents, past the 25, 50, and 75, until I came to the one guilder section. And there was exactly what I wanted, a clock looking like a real clock, made out of chocolate, covered with foil in different colors. And my mother had asked for a clock for the small room off the hall that we used as dining room, and my mother did her sewing there. And there was no clock on the mantel, and she would like a small clock. And my father would no doubt buy her one, but I had to make sure that on St. Nicholas Eve, mother would get my clock first, so she would think that that was the real present. And fooling a person a bit was part of the St. Nicholas tradition. As I stood waiting for my purchase to be wrapped, I was trying out rhyme words in my head, because St. Nicholas' presents had to be accompanied by a verse. Signed St. Nicholas, keeping the identity of the actual giver secret. And I remember that I wrote something like klokje voor uw kamertje, a little clock for your room, that's what my mother wanted. But here is a clock just as you asked for, you know, and it had several, it said some nice things about her, it didn't say ugly things. Well, as I said to you, very small children were not included in the December 5th St. Nicholas Eve celebration. They were taken to bed early, but they had first put up their shoe, as it was called, often a wooden shoe, near the chimney, and they had usually some carrots and some hay in there, because after all, St. Nicholas' horse needed something, and that would be gone the next morning, taken by Black Peter to give to the Schimmel, that was the white horse of Sinterklaas, and it would be filled with little goodies, or maybe with instructions to look somewhere else in the house. I remember when I was really small, there would be a little table set next to the chimney, covered with a white cloth and all kinds of goodies on top of it. And once I had to search all over the house because I found a message that said, go look for your present. So this was, you know, when you could read, then you could be directed someplace. And I searched that we had just moved to a big house, and I finally opened the door to a storage room. And there, sitting in her own chair, was my doll. But she was wearing a new wardrobe that my mother had made, a brown winter coat set off with gray astrakhan that's closely curled wool, and a green crocheted beret. And she also had a new dress with lace at the neck, a nightgown, and a small suitcase to hold all the doll's clothes. I remember that very, very well. That was a beautiful St. Nicholas. And one December, my father asked for my help. I was a bigger child then. And he said, I'm having a wooden lamp made for the living room as a special present for mother. But it won't be ready on December the 5th, and what shall we do? Can you think of something? And I came up with the idea, let's find a Chinese lantern, and we could light it and hang it somewhere in the house. My voice trailed off. I had no idea how to go about the details, but my father did. He wrote a long poem in which he told my mother to figure out the place where the gift was hidden. Well, my father was a geographer, and he would get annoyed with my mother because she would be totally incapable of figuring out places like north, northeast, or southwest, or any of that. And so he wrote this poem with complicated instructions of going northeast or northwest and south and so on. And he was making fun of the fact that she had so much trouble with directional instructions. But not this time. She read the poem out loud and said immediately, it's in the upstairs bathroom. And she knew, and we all trooped up there, and there was the biggest Chinese lantern I had been able to find, and it was a yellow moon, and attached to it was the promise of the lamp that would be coming later. So that was the kind of, you know, little trips that you would send your people on before they received their gifts. So I do remember, and I want to tell you that because I think I was in first grade, and I remember being sure I had seen a white gloved hand move behind the metal screen in the wall at the same time that I heard a noise like a chain rattling. You see, Black Peter was supposed to carry a chain to frighten the children, and supposedly he could take you away in chains to Spain if you hadn't been good. And moments later, the door opened just a crack, and candies and pepernoten, that were those tiny spicy cookies, were thrown into the room, much like a piñata bursting. And I also remember very vividly that we received word twice that St. Nicholas himself was visiting our dentist, who had young children, and we were invited to come and be there when he would arrive. And I have actually pictures of myself sitting there with a present in my lap. And I later told my mother that Black Peter played exactly the same games with us as my big brother Jaap always did. So that was St. Nicholas in the Netherlands when I was young. And the gift giving was over, and then there were like 3 weeks before it was time for Christmas. And then there were no gifts to worry about. So Christmas was celebrated much in the way Thanksgiving is in the United States. It was a time to invite family and friends, especially those that might otherwise be by themselves, invite them for dinner, and of course good food was very much part and parcel of the celebrations. And usually we would dress the table very simply, but for Christmas there would be a white tablecloth with red ribbons. And I remember very well, especially since I had an older sister and a cousin who lived with us, who was 10 years older than I was, and they, of course, excelled in making nice decorations for the table, which I really liked. But it was a very peaceful holiday. No long preparations like we have in the United States, not even baking of cookies, which were bought in town at our fancy bakers, who baked no bread, only cookies, cakes, and treats, like filled cakes is something that the Dutch baker, like in Marysville, will make. It is an almond paste filled round cook that you, that our grandchildren, when they were very small, absolutely loved. So you may, as I say to them, you may have had those from the Dutch store. And one bread we did make was Christmas bread with raisins, currants, candied citron, and ground almonds. And of course the puff pastry with almond paste, that was part of Christmas too, this time in the shape of a ring and decorated with candied fruit. It was called a Christmas wreath. And there were also tiny chocolate wreaths to go with the afternoon tea, and reshaped butter cookies sprinkled with sliced almonds. It is mouth-watering when you read about all that. Well, my dad and I would go to the nursery to get our Christmas tree. And we would do that a few days before Christmas. And then we picked holly and brought home fir branches and decorated the living room. And my mother liked to make what she called Christmas pieces, small arrangements of greens, a few flowers if she had any, a candle, all put together in a tiny basket or a small container, and she would take those to people who were ill or housebound, and that was really part of what she did in order to make Christmas time a good time for others who might not have family around. And you remember, we had real candles on the tree. Nothing of this electric light business. And you were clipping the candles to the branches, and very carefully, because otherwise it would tip the branch. And on Christmas Day, and again the next day, because the Dutch, like most Europeans, have 2 days of Christmas, two complete holidays, very nice. And then we would burn the tree for a little while longer, and there would be a large basin of water and a sponge in readiness, but I cannot remember any trouble because we were all watching out for the burning candles. And then we listened to my father read a Christmas story from the Bible in Dutch, and then a Frisian tale that he particularly liked. And then we gathered round the piano to sing Christmas carols in different languages. And the tree stayed up through New Year's, and sometimes we lit it once more on New Year's Eve. Well, I tell you, New Year's Eve was a very busy day, because what the Dutch eat then is called oliebollen, deep-fried, donut-like treats made with yeast. And the dough needed time to rise, so you had to plan when to get started. And after we arranged the oliebollen on a platter or in a bowl, we sprinkled them with powdered sugar. My mother often had me take some to friends who otherwise might not have this special New Year's Eve treat. And another New Year's Eve delicacy were snowballs, light and fluffy, made with eggs. And those, as well as apple rings dipped in batter and deep fried, were enjoyed during the evening as we played games until it was time to wish each other Happy New Year. And we stayed up much beyond midnight, then we might very well serve a light supper with maybe a herring salad, cheeses and fruit. And then on New Year's Day, we ate leftover goodies and braced ourselves for the somber, dark, and cold months of January. At least, that's how I felt like a child. But the days between Christmas and New Year's were magical. And that's what I missed when I came to the United States, because I did not realize that the day after Christmas, most Christmas tree would be at the curb with a tinsel, and there would be no more classical Christmas music on the radio. It was all over and done with, and it had started way too early. I remember our oldest grandson, who was then 3 years old, and we were walking through a large department store through the mezzanine, and there were Christmas trees, and it was mid-October, and the little boy said, "Christmas trees? We haven't even had Halloween yet." And he was quite right. It was way too early. And so what really happens is that the commercial aspects of Christmas are so important, of the gift giving, because we know the words Black Friday and what it means, that the books should be in the black, and how even bookstores depend on at least one-third of their sales should be done at Christmas. One-third of the sales of the whole year. And some of that has changed what people would like. And I think it's important to remember that we ourselves can celebrate within our own family and with our friends the way we would like to celebrate. We do not have to follow all the commercial guidance that we are so plentifully supplied with. Well, I've taken you through the whole month of December, but Lori, we still have to hear of some of your Christmas traditions when you were young.
Yeah, and our traditions were very different than yours, Allie, and it makes me a little, I don't know, there's a little sadness when I hear about your traditions because yours seems so rich and so culturally based. You know, you're talking about the traditions of the Netherlands, and I can't really speak from that perspective of the traditions of the United States. But I can tell you about our family traditions. Growing up as a youngster in the 1950s in Seattle, in the Northwest. And the traditions I'll tell you about really were unique to the Ball family, my maiden name, Ball. Jan and Elmer were my parents, and they're the four of us children. We lived in the north of Seattle. I guess you'd call us a middle-class family. My father had dropped out of high school to join the Civilian Conservation Corps when he was 16. He didn't get his high school diploma until he was in the Navy, and he'd actually lied about his age at age 17 to join the Navy early.
Because you had to be 18.
You had to be 18. And he rose to the highest rank of an enlisted man. During those years, he was an aviation metalsmith chief. Now, in the early 1950s, so he's got this family of six he's looking after, and he's a chief at Sandpoint Naval Air Station in North Seattle. But to support our family, he also had to have two other jobs. My mother stayed home, as most mothers did in those days, which plays into our Christmas traditions, too. And Dad's other two jobs, he was a bartender at Sandpoint Chiefs Club on the weekends. And how he had enough time for a completely separate profession, which he was a professional photographer, and he and my mother had the Jan L. Wedding and Portrait Studio. And in those days, there was no color film. Dad was a photographer for individual families and these special events. All the photography in black and white. And my mother hand-tinted those photographs to give color to them. Yes. Mm. So we say that I came from a middle-class family, but maybe the definitions have changed. When I think of those days, those December holidays, we certainly didn't have a lot of money. But then I think folks who were middle-class in our neighborhood in those days didn't either, and it's just the way it was. For example, when we shopped for our Christmas gifts in the month of December, we never went to Nordstrom.
Look at the windows.
We went window shopping at the Bon Marché in Nordstrom in Northgate, which at that point, by the way, was not an enclosed mall. It was the largest mall west of the Mississippi, but it was an outdoor strip mall back in the early 1950s. With Nordstrom and the Bon Marché being the two big retailers in those malls. But where my parents got our Christmas gifts, and of course we didn't know they were from our parents at that time, we thought they were from Santa Claus, was at St. Vincent de Paul and at the Goodwill. And what they would do was go down before Christmas and pick up presents and toys and such and refurbish them. They would spend the weeks before Christmas repainting and repairing and refurbishing these gifts, and on Christmas morning they were all presented to us from Santa Claus, and we didn't know that they hadn't come from the finest stores. I remember one gift in particular, though we had lots of gifts, and all of them didn't come from St. Vincent de Paul. Some of them, I think, did come from stores as time went on and my parents' income grew, but one was a record player, and I remember the cabinet of this record player. It was painted, I think, a lovely soft yellow, and I remember there were decals on the front, and it was the top flipped up, and inside was the record player, and there was a door on the front you opened up, and there were stored the records. And I'm thinking that actually that gift came to all four of us kids. One gift.
For everybody.
Oh, yeah. From Santa Claus. Mm-hmm.
Because you were close enough in age that you could enjoy the same things.
Exactly, yeah. Some of the things of the Christmas traditions I especially remember was My mother would make all four of us new Christmas outfits. She'd sew new Christmas outfits for us every year. The boys got blazers. My two brothers got blazers. And my sister and I always got new dresses. And my mother would make herself a new dress, too. I'm actually holding in my hand here a Christmas photograph, and I have my new pink dotted Swiss dress on with a really sweet satin sash that tied in a big bow in the back. And my sister has something not out of dotted Swiss, because she was 5.5 years older, of course. Oh, yeah. So hers were more formal. And my mother a taffeta skirt. We were all color coordinated.
Ah.
I don't know how she had time to do these things, Allie.
But it would give a great satisfaction, I'm sure.
I'm sure it did. Yeah. My parents got by on less sleep in those years than we did. So another of our family traditions was the family photograph, of course, because my father and mother had a photo studio. The other day I was thinking about this our opportunity to share our reminiscences on the radio, and I emailed my younger brother Randy and asked him about that. And he emailed back some thoughts about taking the family photograph, and I'd like to read that to you. And the photograph that they took every year was sent out in the little Christmas card, by the way. So here's what my brother Randy had to say. A few weeks before Christmas, Mom and Dad got us all together to have the family photo made. Of course, it was in the evening time after Dad got off work. Mom and you girls got in your new matching dresses, and Ron and I were in our matching sports coats, and we were all arranged by my father in front of the upstairs fireplace beside the Christmas tree, of course. And my brother is remembering here that Dad would take photograph after photograph late into the night till he could get the perfect one. He had an old 4x5 camera, and it was mounted on a tripod. He would get in the picture himself and somehow trip the shutter so that all six of us were in the picture, and there was we didn't have to have a separate photographer standing behind the camera. Before each shot, he would change the plate in the back of the camera. He would lick the end of the huge round flash bulb and shove it into the flash unit. And my brother said he still remembers the crinkling sound that the flash bulb would make when it fired off. And his memory, which differs from mine, was that these photo shoots would go on till 11 o'clock in the evening.
Really?
He remembers one night when he, the youngest in the family, had tears running down his face. Daddy, can I please go to sleep? And my dad said, just one more shot.
Beautiful.
So I have one of these photographs in its little red holiday greeting card in front of me. And this is, both of my parents are passed on now, but this card, it comes out of my Christmas box every year. It's interesting to me, Allie, because it tells a lot about those days. It's a letter my mother wrote to her mother. And she just says, hi, dear Mom. And she tells what's going on at Christmas that year. Tells that we're going to go up skiing over the holidays. And my father's going to take the boys steelhead fishing over the holidays. Now, we got all the gear for that. We checked it out at the Navy base. Everybody didn't have to have their own ski gear back in those days. We didn't have to have our own fishing poles. We just checked it out at the base and used it. And then checked it back in again. And she wishes her mom happy Christmas. And she signs it. It chokes me up. She just signs it, love from Jan, Elmer, and the kids. Now, what's interesting about this to me is she couldn't pick up the phone and just call her mom on Christmas like any of us would do these days. Long distance wasn't in everybody's, it just wasn't a normal part of life back then.
No.
And obviously, she didn't feel obliged to, go shopping and wrap up something and send an expensive gift to her mom either. Mm-hmm. So in the 1950s, in our family, in our neighborhood, even for family members who didn't happen to be local, you would just send a card. Mm-hmm. So different than the way things are
right
today.
Things have become much more elaborate and generous and all of that, and we think it has to be that way.
We do. Think it has. Another memory I have about those days is the fact that the stores weren't open on Sundays in Seattle in the early 1950s.
No, they were not.
No, everything was closed on Sunday. It was a family day. Mm-hmm. And even throughout December, in our family days, my parents would pile us all into our car. We had a Kaiser, and take a drive around. We'd drive to the country. That's what we did on Sunday afternoons. Mm-hmm. During the Christmas season, we would also pile into the car, remembering that that car didn't have much of a heater, so we'd all bring our blankets, and we were all, I imagine, also dressed pretty warmly in our jammies, and drive around one night before Christmas time and look at all the Christmas
lights.
Yeah. See all the lights in the neighborhood. That was a special Christmas memory. I have this very sweet Christmas memory. Again, these are just my memories, not traditions, but of laying in my parents' bed probably a night or two before Christmas, and they would have those, you know, the multicolored Christmas lights strung outside their window, and they had kind of opaque windows. It wasn't clear glass, but more brick-like opaque glass. And I just have such a comforting, warm feeling in my heart of falling asleep, looking at those lights diffused through the windows of my parents, through the glass of my parents' windows, my head on Mom or Dad's pillow, kind of waiting for Santa Claus, waiting to hear maybe the jingle of the reindeer. Those jingle bells, that's right.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Laurie. That was lovely. And we have come to the end of our program of Santa Claus and Sinterklaas traditions and memories. And we hope that all of you will have a happy, healthy New Year.
Mm-hmm.
This program was pre-recorded.